Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 9:06 a.m. on Thursday, February 5, 2026. And present today, we have Representative Allard, Representative Hannon, Representative Moore, Representative Co-Chair Trogi, Representative Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, and Representative Stepp, as well as myself, Co-Chair Foster. Morning, everyone. Looks like we've got a pretty full house today. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. We have one bill before the committee this morning, and that's House Bill 284. It's the governor's omnibus tax bill. And the plan is to introduce the bill and have the Department of Revenue give a presentation. Then we'd like to have a presentation from the Alaska Municipal League. And I believe that's Nils Andreasen. There you are. And then this evening, starting at 5:30, we'd like to get some feedback from the public on this bill. And so, again, at 5:30, we'll be taking some public testimony. At that meeting, what I'd like to do is just have a really short overview, just to kind of bring the public up to speed, just kind of hitting the highlights and give the brief overview of the bill, and then we'll go into public testimony. So with that, I'd like to invite up, glad somebody mentioned this. Thank you, Representative Hannon. Would like to recognize that we do have some legislators in the room, and thanks for being here today. We do have Representative Cologne, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Elam, and I think I have everyone. And so with that, appreciate you being here. So I'd like to invite up to the table Ms. Janelle Earls, the Administrative Services Director and Acting Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, Brandon Spanos, Acting Tax Director, Department of Revenue, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist, Department of Revenue. If you could all please come up to the table and put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation. We do have quite a few slides in the slide deck, so what I would like to do is if maybe folks could hold their questions until the end of each section. I think that might help to speed things up a little bit while at the same time allowing folks to ask questions. So again, if we could just hold questions until the end of each section. And with that, Commissioner, thanks for being here today.
Thank you all for having us here, House Finance Committee. Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner and Administrative Services Director for the Department of Revenue. Here with me today are Acting Tax Director Brandon Spanos and Chief Economist Dan Stickle. We are here today to present on the Governor's Tax Bill, House Bill 284. As Representative Foster said, we have a long presentation today on a large bill, so we'll try to get through each slide fairly quickly. This presentation will first go through policy goals, talk about each component of the bill, and if there is time, the fiscal note and sectional analysis. Next slide. The governor's policy goals are to provide a plan for fiscal stability, limit spending, improve Alaska's long-term appeal for families and businesses, to ensure a predictable PFD, and require agency operations be reviewed on a regular basis. And slide five is just the fiscal plan in more detail. I will now turn it over to Acting Director Spanos and Chief Economist Stickle. They have 20 years of experience each with the tax division and are well-suited to answer your tax questions.
Representative Allard, did you have a question or Representative Stepp? Representative Stepp?
Yep, thank Co-Chair Foster. through the chair, to our wonderful revenue folks, thanks for being here. And it's good to see you guys, as always. I'm just on slide four, where we look to articulate the policy objectives of this proposal. I think it's probably going to be interesting as we walk through this bill to determine whether or not aspects of this bill actually do that, right? especially on point three, improving Alaska's long-term appeal for families and businesses. So I fail to see how enshrining a liability that outstrips the amount of revenue I'm raising in taxation creates anything but more instability and a need for more taxes, but I look forward to having you guys articulate that as we go through the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed with the presentation.
So for the record, Brandon Spanos, Acting Director with the Tax Division, apologize for my voice. It didn't get me out of coming up and presenting, though. So,
good try.
Yeah. So moving into the omnibus bill, as you stated, Mr. Chair, it's a relatively long presentation because it's a relatively long bill. There are three main components of the bill. That is the first, the proposed seasonal sales tax. Second, updates to an eventual elimination of the corporate income tax, and third, two changes to the oil and gas production tax. The first change there is raising the minimum tax floor from 4% to 6%, and then second, adding a new fee for pipeline corridor maintenance. We'll go through each of the components one at a time, and I appreciate, as Mr. Chair, you noted, questions could be held until the end of each section to allow us to get through all of these slides. So first we'll go over the sales tax. This is the largest section of the bill because it's standing up a new statute. So the tax rate would be 4% for half of the year and 2% for the other half of the year. It has certain exemptions, which I'll go over in more detail in later slides, and it would also be administered by the state, which I'll also go through in more detail in later slides. The bill provides for timely allowance of the lesser of 1% or $75 for the seller for the burden of collecting and remitting the tax to the state. Moving on to slide 10, the tax is on the consumer or the purchaser and is collected and remitted to the state by the business that sells the product or the service. For those who itemize deductions on their federal tax return, they can itemize the sales tax as one of those deductions. Slide 11. Most people understand what a sales tax is. We put in the slide specifically about the use tax because there's often confusion on what that is. A use tax is basically a complementary tax to a sales tax, and it basically tries to close a loophole of if you purchase an item in another non-tax jurisdiction and bring it into the state to use it, that you still would pay the tax. So when the sales tax applies, the use tax does not, and when the use tax applies, the sales tax does not. They're mutually exclusive. It only applies to sales so this used to be mainly for online sales. Those are mostly taxed now after the Wayfair Supreme Court decision, which we'll get into a bit more. So states used to apply the use tax to those, and it was on the honor system, and they had a hard time collecting those taxes. And today, that's larger items like cars and such are what states mainly capture, and then it's still on the honor system for everything else. So we would envision our bill has a requirement to when you register your vehicle, you would pay the tax. So those would be captured. Other things like major purchases that are brought in through customs are reported to the tax division. So those would also be captured. Other things would have to be self-reported. So moving on to slide 12. Historically, as I mentioned, internet sales were not taxed by states unless the seller had a physical presence in the state, and this was the result of a string of cases, but the most recent case in that string was Quill Corp. versus North Dakota, where in that case the U.S. Supreme Court decided back in 1992 that most sales from just stepping back a little bit, back in 92 and pre 92, most sales were done, cross-border sales were done through mail order. Fast forward to 2000, physical presence was not as much of a concern for states. and they started to question if that standard should still be applied, given that most cross-border sales were now internet-based and the computers made the burden of tracking taxes in various jurisdictions simpler. So in Quill, the court had decided or stated that the burden of a taxpayer shouldn't have to know the burden, a seller of goods shouldn't have to know the burden in the hundreds of jurisdictions that it sells its goods into. And because of that, it was overly burdensome. They shouldn't have to collect the tax at all, and the burden should be on the individual resident to remit and, or rather, report and remit the tax. South Dakota decided to challenge that because online sales was very prominent and modern computer systems allowed for simpler tracking and reporting. And they passed a law that crafted specifically to challenge that physical presence standard that was, which was in the Quill case. They started a movement that was coined Kill Quill that was pretty popular among states and certain tax attorneys. South Dakota applied its sales tax to internet sales through a statute change, which was challenged by Wayfair, a online seller of goods and furniture. The case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which overturned the prior precedent in the Quill case by stating that the as long as a state met three criteria, it could apply the sales tax to remote sellers that had no physical presence in their state. And so those three criteria are a company must have substantial nexus, substantial economic nexus with the state. This bill does that by having a threshold of $100,000 sales into the state, which the U.S. Supreme Court determined in South Dakota was a substantial nexus. And second, a state must apply non-discriminatory standards to all sellers. And this bill meets that test by having only one sales tax that applies to in-state and out-of-state sellers in the same way and in the same manner, except for that $100,000 threshold, which is the test in the first test. And then third, a state must not impose undue burdens on interstate commerce by ensuring that the compliance process is reasonable and fair. This bill proposes to do that in a way, in the same way that South Dakota did that, which is by having all sales tax in the state administered at the state level. So moving on to slide 13.
Would like to note we also have with us Representative Bynum, and we're actually going to hold questions till after each section, if that's okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. Taxes would be remitted to the state by the seller using our revenue online system, which is electronic filing of tax returns, electronic payments, and electronic communication with the tax division in a secure system. As I stated in the last slide, the state would administer the tax to be compliant with the Wayfair case. In that case, the Supreme Court highlighted that this South Dakota system for administering sales and use tax was designed to minimize burdens in interstate commerce. And one of the key factors was centralized administration. The court pointed out that South Dakota had a single state-level taxing authority that handled both state and local taxes. This means the sellers had to register, file, and remit through one system. They didn't need to deal separately with hundreds of local tax jurisdictions. This streamlined approach reduced compliance, complexity, and supported the court's finding that the law did not impose an undue burden on interstate commerce. The court contrasted this with states that have fragmented systems, which could create significant administrative challenges for remote sellers. South Dakota's centralized system was cited as a reason it was constitutionally sound under the Commerce Clause. Moving to slide 14, the vast majority of states levy a sales tax and a use tax. At the seasonal 4% rate that's proposed in this bill, Alaska would tie as the tie with five other states as the second lowest tax rate in the nation. At the 2% tax rate, we would be the lowest tax in the nation at the state level. If we combined the local, the average local sales tax rates, Alaska would be the sixth lowest combined when other states combine their average local tax rates. And the very broad base that that you see in the bill allows for a low rate. Slide 15, the intent behind the legislation is to create a very broad base that applies to most consumer goods and services, allowing for one of the lowest rates in the nation, as we just mentioned. The governor deliberately excluded intermediate business transactions, which can lead to tax pyramiding and the goods being even more than just one tax level. They could have multiple tax levels in the chain of a good as it makes its way to the consumer. The way the bill is structured is straightforward. It starts with the assumption that all goods and services are taxed, and then it lists specific exemptions one by one. This approach is administratively simpler than trying to define which or what is taxable from scratch. It gives clarity and consistency. And then on the next slide is where we start to go through the exemptions. I'm not going to read all the exemptions. I will just leave the slide up here for a minute and then move to the next slide where there are even more exemptions. Most of the exemptions are either exemptions where the state doesn't want to tax itself, exemptions that are required by the federal government, or exemptions that just make sense, like employee wages, that are usually taxed under an income tax rather than a sales tax. And slide 17 lists more there, and we have been asked about that jet fuel a few times, so I'll just highlight that one. This goes back to interstate and international commerce. States cannot tax getting goods from point A to point B for interstate or international commerce. So the only thing that you can tax is the fuel used in your airspace. You can't tax the fuel used in international flights or interstate flights when they're used in interstate commerce, which most of our flights are. So rather than do what having some complicated credit system to apply only the tax to the sale of fuel used in our airspace, the decision was made to exclude jet fuel completely, which is also excluded on our motor fuel tax and the different fees that are out there for, like, the SPAR. Jet fuel is also excluded there.
Got a question, Representative Stapp, and it looks like that takes us through the first section. Just for the public, we're looking at three sections of this omnibus bill. That's the sales tax, corporate tax, and oil and gas taxes. So thank you very much for that was a good high-level introduction, I think, and I'm sure there are going to be a lot of questions, probably a lot to unpack there. I think we've got Representative Stapp and then Representative Galvin. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I have a few in succession, if that's permissible, through the chair.
Sure, Representative Stapp.
Director Spanos. First, Wayfair case also had a second test. It was a transactions test. I think it was a 200-plus annual transactions. I do not see that outlined in the bill through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, after Wayfair was decided, first of all, South Dakota wanted to ensure that they were going to meet that standard, and so they had two tests. Most states currently only have one test, and in talking to those states, they strongly recommend that you do not use the transaction test because you can sell 200 keychains into a state, and the total cost might only be $50, and now you're requiring them to file a tax and remit tax on that $50, and it was just overly burdensome. So the $100,000 is the current standard for most states.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Coach.
Follow up?
Yeah, thank you. So on slide 11, I was hoping that you could perhaps break this down a little bit more regarding the mechanics of the way the use tax works. So the way I read this, it says the tax basically would be applied on anything that could have been sold in the state, including purchases made outside and then brought into the state. So a lot of Alaskans buy vehicles in Washington and bring them into Alaska. In that scenario, if this bill were to pass, what happens to the use fee on that or tax on that type of purchase through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, if you purchase a vehicle, if this bill were to pass and you purchased the vehicle out of state, brought it into state, when you went to register the vehicle, that's when the use tax would be applied.
Fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Hello?
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so just to be on it, just to be clear, if this bill were to go into law, all those folks who buy their vehicles out of state, as soon as they would register, they'd have to pay the 4% or 2%. On that point, like, does it Now, is the point of the purchase where we're going to apply the seasonal sales tax, or is it the point of registrations? Because obviously there's a material difference between registering at 4% and then registering at 2% through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, most states do this the same way. They have the tax paid at the registration, and the reason for that is that there are a lot of sales done between unrelated purchasers that aren't businesses, and so the states capture the tax by at the point of the registration for a vehicle specifically. However, if you purchase a vehicle at a dealership, I'd have to look into that. Some states may have a transaction there as well, but I believe that almost all of them are at the DMV level.
Okay. Continuing on, Mr.
Representative Stapp.
Yep. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So getting into, and I won't kind of go through this like super in-depthly on the exemptions, but explain to me, we are exempting purchases made with through WIC and food stamps, but we are not exempting the things that you use WIC for to people who aren't on that. So, for example, diapers, formula, that type of stuff. All those things are currently taxed under this broad proposal unless you are purchasing them or receiving them through WIC or through food stamps or some other type of public assistance program. Is that correct through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, that's correct.
Okay. My last fault, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you. How are we improving Alaskans' lives, as it shows on slide 4? How is the objective to make this a state that has more appealing long-term for families when we're taxing purchases of vehicles out of state, taxing formula and diapers that they use, taxing fuel purchases that's not jet fuel? How are we improving families' lives in Alaska by doing this through the chair?
Commissioner Earls?
Janelle Earls, Acting Commissioner, again, Representative Stapp through the chair. This is the comprehensive fiscal plan the governor has put together. It still allows for the PFD and a small share of sales tax.
Yeah. I'm just reading off the slide through the chair. It says, on slide 4, it says, we're improving Alaska's long-term appeal for families and businesses by doing this. And I'm failing to see how taxing all those things would achieve that outcome. But I know there's more to the proposal, so I'll probably go back to this point a few times. But thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Let's see. At the beginning of the presentation, we had Representative Galvin who had a question, and then Representative Bynum, Representative Hannon, and Representative Allard. So next we'll go to Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you for being here. I appreciate that the governor is putting something forward around revenue. I really appreciate this conversation. I understand the fiscal cliff that we're now starting to face, and I also understand that we want to keep Alaskans here safely on roads that they can travel on and in schools where our families want to spend their time and feel proud that we are supporting as a state these important pieces. So thank you for this. And I, with this particular piece in mind, the sales tax, I want to ask us three different questions, if I may.
Sure.
Firstly, around your decision on slide 9, thank you, to call this seasonal sales tax. In this case, it is a sales tax that is year-round. It is adjusted as far. I just want to make sure that I'm reading this right. It's not what most people think of as a seasonal sales tax, which means typically some states do this when they know there's going to be a large influx of visitors into the state. They want to make sure if they're using the roads and they're using the systems that they're also paying a little extra when they're spending their money on products. And perhaps that's why we've chosen the different dates, but I do see that Alaskans are being taxed year-round. Could you confirm that?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, when I when we were putting this presentation together, I had the same concern. I was like, seasonal is usually means that, but I did actually have to Google it and look it up. And there are states that have a rate that changes seasonally that they call a seasonal sales tax. So we did determine that, well, it's pretty standard to call that also seasonal. I wanted to call it a seasonally adjusted rate. So that's another term that you could use, but there are states that call it a seasonal rate when it's just seasonally adjusted.
I appreciate that very much. And in a state where we've not had this before, it makes sense to call it whatever it is that helps people appreciate what it is. And so in this case, I like your suggestion of a seasonally adjusted sales tax because it is a sales tax year-round for all Alaskans. So thank you for that. And then
if I may, there was a slide that noted the breakout as well. It was a 70-30 split when we combined those rates over the and in doing it seasonally and having the 4% rate during a tourist season, that does reduce the tax burden on residents. Without that, I think it was it a 75-25 split?
Thank you. And if I may, a follow-up?
Yes, I'd like to quickly welcome Representative Underwood to House Finance. Thanks for joining us, Representative Galvin.
Thank you. And the next question, I'm going to give a little context because I think it may be helpful given this larger, broader conversation. I wanted to ask you to comment on sales tax versus income tax. And before I get to your answer, I want to state that Alaska's context, which I'm sure we'll be hearing about, we already have over 100 municipalities and with local sales tax, as you know, and it's different in every single community. Not in every community do we have a sales tax. I appreciate that. In Anchorage, we do not yet, but it's complicated. And I also know that sales taxes, when you look at historically all across American cities, what I'm hearing from when I've done my research from many of the economists, that it does have more impact on families with less, without question. Economists say that. It has more impact on families with less. Also, regional price disparities in Alaska especially would disproportionately hurt rural residents if a statewide tax is put in place. And the burden on non-residents is substantially different, especially non-residents who come up here and make over $200,000 a year by coming up for 2 weeks, going to the North Slope, and then going back home. And they pay income taxes and oftentimes sales taxes in their region, their other state where they live. I warmly welcome those workers to still continue coming, but when you were considering sales versus income, I hope that there was some discussion around this, and I hope that you can give me a bit more reassurance about why a sales tax is a better idea than an income tax, please.
Commissioner Earls.
Through the chair to Representative Galvin, I really appreciate that comment. There is no perfect tax regime. By having the sales tax, we are able to collect from non-resident workers and tourists as well. So it's not fully the burden of the residents of Alaska.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Do you have any research that shows that non-resident workers come up here and spend time and a lot of their money in a way that would pour into our Alaska state revenue pot, if you will? I have a lot of my own research from what I've seen that many of those workers get on a plane, go straight to the North Slope, get back on the plane. They always get the first class seats because they're high flyers, right? And I'm not against that, but I just want us to understand that they are not necessarily in my mind. But if you have data that proves otherwise, I'm all into here that I know they go fishing occasionally and things like that. But I would like to see data that shows, if you have it, that we are capturing important revenue for Alaska by instead of capturing 2 or 4% of their income, which, by the way, is less than what they're paying back home. So we're not going to lose any workers. They're not going to be double taxed if there's an income tax. That doesn't happen. It's not legal. But I don't know that the 2 or 4% would give us a lot more funds if it's put on the sales versus income. So that's the data. Or if you have any broad understanding of that, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Galvin, through the chair. I would have to double check to see if we have data.
Sure, maybe I can jump in here. Dan Stickles, Chief Economist with Department of Revenue, to Representative Galvin through the chair. So we do have some information about potential contribution to sales tax from non-resident workers. So broadly speaking, there's three groups of individuals who would pay the tax. There's the Alaska residents. There's your more traditional tourists who are coming here on cruise ships or independent tours. And then there are the non-resident workers. Some of those non-resident workers are coming here for extended periods of time, for instance, in the tourism and fishing industry, oil and gas mining as well. But the model does specifically break out the share of revenue that comes from those non-resident workers, and we could provide that.
Great. That would be very helpful. And if we could compare it to what 2 or 4% of income versus the model of what they're bringing in from sales, that would be a great comparative study for us. Thank you. And if I may, I have one last follow-up.
Representative Galvin.
Actually, I'm going to hold on that because I know there's other questions. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. In line, I've got Representative Bynum, Hannon, Allard, Tomaszewski, and Josephson. And I don't see any other hands. So with that, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. What an interesting topic we have in front of us here today. Really looking forward to getting more into this. We went through the slide deck here on the presentation of sales tax, and I think there's going to be probably lots of questions swirling around that because I don't think the 15 slides or so that we have here will adequately convey to not just this committee but to the Alaskan people on why this is the route that we want to take. But Representative Stapp had actually asked a question that I was thinking about here quite a bit. It was about vehicle registration and when does that apply? Are we going to have all of our Alaskans buying vehicles in the wintertime because they don't want to be subject to a 4% in the summertime? But so appreciate that question being asked and look forward to the answer on that. But one of the things that is interesting about this particular proposal is that I understand that we're trying to capture revenue from all of our visitors. And for those of us that watched the ICER presentation on this topic, one of the things they talked about was using the sales tax mechanism to create stability. However, as it not being as volatile as maybe other forms of taxation, but at that presentation, I asked the question of, how is that being modeled, and why are you modeling it that way? Because we know that in Alaska, if we're trying to capture non-resident revenue through visitors, that those opportunities are tied to the economic condition of the country. And so when we see that cost of travel or there's an economic instability in the country, maybe in the world, that the volume of people actually coming to our state for travel may go down. But even if it doesn't go down, their spending habits absolutely do change. Now, I come from a community where we have a sales tax. And I came before I was here on a borough assembly where we monitored what was happening in our economy, which is a very highly influenced by tourism. And we saw that global pandemic wiped out all revenue coming in from a sales tax. We know that instability, we've seen the number of people coming to visit our community has went up. Sometimes it levels off. But even with high numbers of people coming, that when we do have that economic instability, they spend a lot less money. So when I asked this question of ICER, I said, was this taken into consideration? Their answer was no, that they are modeling over the United States as a whole. Okay. So I was just really wanting to know what your perspective on that answer is, and does this truly create a stable income source for Alaskans that's leveraging our visitor industries and people that are here temporarily, or is this fully focused long-term stability going to be placed on the backs of Alaskans to fund this? Is this something that was considered? And if I can re-ask the question, if it wasn't clear what I'm trying to get at here.
Representative Bynum, did you say you're going to rephrase the question?
I'm asking if they need to, me to rephrase the question.
Who would like to take a stab at that? Commissioner Earls?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, if I'm hearing you correctly, you want to ensure that it's not fully going to ride on Alaskans to have these taxes collected. And I think that the study, as you had stated, did not take into those economic downturns. So at this point in time, I'm not entirely sure.
Okay. So,
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, through the chair. So as far as presenting a plan to us that is going to try to, something for us to consider, those particular economic instabilities were not considered as part of this fiscal plan? Is that what you're saying?
Commissioner Earls?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, I may have to turn to Chief Economist Stickle to help answer some of the modeling that has been done.
Thank you.
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Again, Dan Stickle for the record, Representative Bynum through the chair. So I can provide some general perspective around stability on state revenues. Our fiscal system now has a lot of reliance on the oil and gas industry. That tends to be a very volatile revenue source to the state. Looking at other states that do have sales and income taxes, those both tend to be more stable than oil and gas as far as revenue goes. For the states that have sales taxes, those are actually a little less volatile than income taxes in a downturn or an upturn. And one of the reasons for that is income taxes tend to be heavily influenced by things like capital gains. And so you have, when you have a big expansion or downturn, that will lead to either really big stock market gains or losses. And that makes the income tax can be more volatile than a sales tax for other states. So sales tax is generally viewed by economists and tax professionals as one of the most stable revenue sources.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
So when you're evaluating this, my understanding is you're trying to bring forward something you figured would be, or that you believe will be more stable. But in application, when I go through from the presentation you guys were talking about, that the state will set the parameters for what can and can't be collected as far as exemptions. Does that go across the board for the local taxes? Because, again, I'll use my community as an example. I have a borough and a city. We have city taxes. We have borough taxes. We have a sales tax cap. We have a senior sales tax exemption. There's items that are exempted that aren't exempted. And my understanding is that this bill basically tells municipal governments the exemptions and things that will happen will go out the window, and this will be the framework in which we are applying the taxes. Is that an accurate understanding?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, in order to be compliant with the Wayfair decision, centralized administration and also like the same exemptions across the board and the same definitions are standard in states that are doing their best to comply with Wayfair. So this proposal, because we're standing up a brand new tax, we don't want to we want to learn best practices from other states, and other states have said this is by far the best practice. And if there are other exemptions that the state wants in general, they can be added to the bill. There's nothing preventing the legislature from changing. The governor started with a very broad base so that he could have the lowest rate. But if there's certain items that are exempt locally that the committee or the legislature would want to exempt, certainly that is an option that can be done. In order to hit the same revenue target, the rate would then have to go up to match, and we can model that.
Representative Bynum?
Thank you. Through the chair, specifically for that then, did you take into consideration the impacts on those communities that are charging those taxes and the current tax structures that they have? Because with organization in the state, with organized boroughs, there already is a cost shift from the state to those organized boroughs. You know, I've heard through presentations from the governor on this that they've talked a little bit about. There was a talk about, you know, if more people came to the state, that there would be this big burden on the state because services are being provided, and that wouldn't necessarily be good for the state. And then I think about my community. I'm like, well, boy, howdy, I'd love to see my community grow. I mean, kids in my schools, people working in the shops. But those services are being provided by our local communities, whether it's roads or other services, police, fire, all those things are being provided locally through local taxes. So now I have the state telling me we're going to put this sales tax provision in place that discounts every measure that's already been put in place to provide services. So did you take into consideration or have you evaluated the impact in communities that are already taxing their citizens to provide services?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, to be clear, it's the governor's plan, and as the commissioner stated, there is no perfect tax regime. This is the regime that the governor believes is the best for the state, and we did model the impacts on the state. Whether those models went down to the local level, I'll look to Dan Stickle. But the governor did consider all options and landed on a sales tax as the best option for the state at this time.
So, through the chair, I'm going to take that as a no. You didn't consider or evaluate impacts to communities that are already charging or are already collecting sales taxes to support the local communities? Is that
Mr.
what I'm hearing you say?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the governor considered all the options on the table and chose this one.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. In the lineup, I have Representative Hannon, Allard, Tomaszewski, Josephson, Galvin, and Moore. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I think my questions are a little simpler. On slide 14, you say average local sales tax rate in Alaska is 1.82, and I am looking to understand how that calculation was done, whether it was 100 taxing jurisdictions without weight, or the example that Representative Bynum just gave in Ketchikan, most consumers would say we have a 6% sales rate because we've got a city and a borough sales. So were those sales rates counted as two in calculating the average, or were they combined to say purchasing in Ketchikan? Is it 6% in the
You have 8 in the summer, and there's a proposal to go 8.5, so this will put it at
12.5%. Yeah. So I'm not looking to see what it would be with the additional, but I'm reading that average local sales tax rate in Alaska is 1.82, is what currently from 100 jurisdictions that are exercising sales tax.
Just very quickly, I saw the our clerk in the back looking over to see who was speaking. That was Representative Bynum. Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, thank you for the question. I'll have to get back to the committee with my actual reference because when I printed out the page, it didn't come with it, but it's a reputable tax website that does an analysis each year on all the states' sales taxes, and they analyze what those different rates are. They're the ones that came up with that 1.82%, so I'll have to also get back to you on how they computed that. But they compute those that combined local rate for all of the states, and then they rank the states on where you fall.
Follow up.
So
in looking at that, I'll be interested to see whether they counted all municipalities who could exercise and don't, because when I've looked at sales tax, to get us below 2% on an average, there's got to be a lot of our jurisdictions that are only taxing 1%, and I don't hear that from communities that exercise sales tax. So I'm wondering if it's the you know, you've got a city and a borough tax. To the consumer, it's one tax, but to the tax analysis, it may look like it's two different jurisdictions. And whether we're including jurisdictions that don't have any in that when they're looking at the average sales tax in Alaska across all municipalities, if they're including ones who are not exercising that taxation. So, and then I have one other follow-up.
Representative Hannon?
On slide 16, one of the exemptions listed is internet access, and I am looking to define that that means the utility bill you're paying for an internet provider, if that's the definition that you're using as internet access.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the bill drafters added that in because there's a tax freedom act, or excuse me, internet, now I've forgotten the name of the act, Internet Freedom Act, I believe it's what it's called. The federal government preempts and does not allow taxing individuals to connect to the internet, so it would be the cost to access the internet through your either utility or however else you're accessing it.
Representative Hendon,
and that would thank you, Chair Foster, and that would only be to individuals, not to a business, say a cafe that has internet access for its consumers. The businesses would still be taxed on it, but an individual would have an exemption on the utility bill that they paid to an internet provider.
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I would have to get back to you on that, unless Department of Law is here and can answer that right now.
I don't see law online.
Get back to you on that. We do have law here, but they don't have the answer at the moment. So.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next up we've got Representative Ballard.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, so I have a couple of questions, one that I was going to circle back around that Representative from Anchorage had brought up, income tax. The first one I wanted to talk about was, I think it's the sales for resale. So if we already know that there's about a 20% kick up on vehicles up here, and then there's a dealer markup. And if I'm correct, you said if we go down, say, to Oregon, we don't pay tax down there, we ship our car up here, we're going to have to pay a tax on that purchase when we register the vehicle. That's correct, right? Okay. Then if we buy a used car down in the lower 48, ship it up here, are we going to have to pay tax on that when we register it in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, to be clear, it's not just out-of-state sales that are brought to Alaska. All purchases that don't have a specific exemption would have a tax, either at the local sales tax or the use tax. So to answer your question directly, yes, the tax would be applied both to a new vehicle and a used vehicle.
I'm not trying to be sarcastic, thank you. So if I went down and I just bought a whole bunch of stuff and I brought it back by barge, am I paying tax on like clothes, furniture, and everything if I go shopping down there? Or is that like a not? I think it's a good question.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, I agree. That is a good question. There is an exemption for moving to Alaska and bringing all of your household goods with you. The use tax would not apply in that case. But if you go shopping and bring in items, the tax would apply. But it would be you would have to self-report that. We wouldn't have any way of knowing that you brought goods into the state. So states commonly have a non-reporting, right, non-filing. People do that and don't report it, and the state has few mechanisms to capture that. But yes, there would be a self-reporting requirement in the statute.
Okay, just to comment on that part, I'm glad I'm military, because then I would be purchasing everything through the military PX. Okay, so cars included. Okay, so then the other question is, the representative from Anchorage had brought up income tax, and the reason I want this on the record, we have approximately 11,045 military retirees. If we and we have approximately 9,000 federal retirees, and right now they're not. So there's of the military retirees, it's approximately over 15%. So we have the highest per capita basically in the nation. That's a lot. So if we were to instill an income tax, I'm not saying we need to. I'm not saying I want to. And frankly, I don't want any of this. But if we were to do that, are we looking at, have you researched that to counter when someone talks about the income tax of how detrimental that would be because of the loss of the military persons? I mean, I'm going to be frank with you. When we came up to retire, well, when we came up almost 20 years ago, Alaska was high consideration because they don't tax our federal income when it comes to retirement. Have you guys have any way of countering so that when my esteemed colleagues from other jurisdictions comment about income tax, how are you going to counter that?
So through the chair, Representative Allard, as noted earlier, Dan Stickel and I have been with the division for a long time. We've presented on income taxes, sales taxes, pretty much any tax that you could think of. We've modeled all sorts of those. The income tax, it's been a little while since I've looked at those models. Dan, do you have an answer for that?
Sure. Dan Stickel, again, to Representative Allard through the chair. Broadly speaking, I think as was stated earlier, there is no perfect tax. Any tax is going to have negative downsides. And, you know, that's true of a sales tax. It's true of an income tax. And, yeah, the impact on population and decision to live in Alaska is one of the impacts of a tax that gets balanced against the positive impacts of having a sustainable fiscal plan. And so that's definitely something that we have modeled in excruciating detail and was covered in the ICER report as well.
Thank you. And I just have a quick comment.
Representative Allard?
Yeah, I would feel that the military would just kind of cross us off the list if everything goes up with the income tax and perhaps even with sales tax. They might cross us off the list to come up here and retire. Because it's notably a lot of income that the military and the federal retirees bring in for the population. There's this, you know, remember the saying about a bridge to nowhere that was coined many, many years ago. I feel like that the sales tax is not a bridge to nowhere. I think it's a bridge to income tax. So I think we all really need to consider how not to possibly do that. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bynum?
I'd just like to note that that bridge to nowhere was actually a bridge to somewhere, and it was in Ketchikan, just for the record. So we have a lot of hard feelings about that bridge.
Thank you for the clarification. Okay, in the lineup I have Representative Tomaszewski, Josephson, Galvin, Moore, and Stapp. I don't see any other hands. So with that, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So my question was what Representative Hannon alluded to with the metrics on how you calculated the average sales tax. So I'm looking forward to how those metrics played out. But I'm also wondering, so whenever we institute any kind of tax like this, we're kind of, everyone's familiar with the camel's nose under the tent, right? And once we institute this, even at a 2 and a 4%, what are the levers and how is it, how can we be assured that it's not going to be 4 and 6% in another year or 6 and 12% years down the road? How easy is it going to be for the next legislature to increase this tax amount in and what would be the ramifications of that on the citizens of Alaska?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, that's a great question. And the control is you. The legislature would, of course, have the ability to change the statutes, and if you view that as the camel's nose under the tent, you need to take that into consideration. However, the governor feels that we are in I think it's everyone realizes that we're in a fiscal difficult situation. A fiscal cliff was mentioned earlier, and the governor wants to have a conversation about how to solve that. And this is the fiscal plan he's put forward to get us to balance our revenues with our expenses, and not doing that, he believes is just not the right thing for us to do. So I think there, of course, we will have concerns about years going forward. But if we look at the reality of the situation, we have those concerns now, and so he wants to act.
Follow up,
Representative Tomaszewski.
So were there any consideration in how we can make it more difficult for this body to go ahead and just unilaterally raise the taxes next year? Was there any consideration? I know it's difficult levers to pull back, but was there any consideration in making it constitutional or no?
Commissioner Earls?
Through the chair to Representative Tomaszewski, the governor feels strongly that we need to be looking at this, you know, all the time. Where are we at fiscally and going forward? A fiscal plan is, even a 10-year fiscal plan is really hard to predict. So the levers are there, though, to turn it up and down.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, in the lineup, I've got Representative, looks like Galvin stepped out, or actually it's Josephson, then Galvin, Moore, Stapp, Shoggy, and Bynum. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. I think sort of consistent with where Representative Bynum was going, my concern, and Representative Hannon, my concern at slide 14 is that to achieve this average local state or sales tax rate of 1.82, it must have considered the larger municipalities and Anchorage and Fairbanks in particular and their zero rates. And because the mean should be closer to 5% or better, and when you add that to existing local rates, while there's an opportunity to raise lots of revenue, I guess, for local governments, because many of them have $1,000 and $2,000 caps on purchases above $1,000 or $2,000. So that may have some enticement for them. It's the centralization of the exemptions, I think, that we're going to hear they fear. And also, at some point, the tax rate, the total tax rate gets so large that it acts as a deterrent for local economies. Do you have any concerns with those issues?
Now, through the chair.
Mr. Spadas.
Co-chair Josephson. Certainly, we have concerns, and the governor would like to not have a tax as well, but that's not the situation we're in. We have a fiscal crisis that needs to be resolved, and the governor feels this is the best solution for this time. There is a zeroing out of the tax rate in after 7 years so that the legislature can look at it again and determine, is it still needed? Do we need to change it? Of course, with such a broad base, we probably need to come back and make some tweaks sooner rather than later as well and look at other options. So, yes, the governor did consider everything that concerns him because he didn't want to pass or ask for a tax either. But that's not the situation we're in. We have to resolve the fiscal problem.
Okay. A follow-up?
Follow-up.
On slide 17, as for trades and businesses, there's a reference to costs being deductible, and the concern I have is that that lots of potential tax might not be captured because all a business is purchases under, at least under this bullet point, I'd have to dive into the language itself, would be tax exempt. How do you assuage my concerns there?
Mr. Spanos?
So through the chair, co-chair Josephson, the intent behind that, and there's more than just that one bullet that are doing the same thing. It's to not tax business-to-business transactions, so business inputs that go to into an item that is later sold. The intent is to have just one sales tax applied to it at the consumer level, and so that's why all the business inputs are exempt. In addition to that, we already tax certain industries with specific items like oil, fish, mining, and we didn't want to overburden those that we're already taxing with other taxes.
Okay. I guess my last question, if I might, is a comment you made, Director Spanos. You said that we, the legislature, could make exemption adjustments that might then require increases to achieve the goal. And this is where I'm most troubled, with great respect for you all, by the total package. I can only all of us can only judge what comes next in our lives experientially. What have I experienced? What I've experienced is that the governor will object to changes to his legislation. And so you made it sound like we were welcome to engage in those sorts of adjustments, but I just haven't experienced that. What I've experienced is I've got to vote for this bill the way it is. And I just don't know how much allowance the legislature has to go it alone and make changes. I don't mean go it alone and that we wouldn't communicate. I don't know if the commissioner has a response to that.
Commissioner Earls?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, I think it's open to some conversation. This is the conversation that we're having on the comprehensive fiscal plan. I can't speak to exactly what the governor would accept, but I think it's a conversation to be had.
Real quick follow-up.
How
would those conversations occur? Would they occur like any other legislation where we would speak to you and you would speak to the third floor? I know that's an odd question, but really, how would they happen?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, they can come through us. We can speak to the governor, and we can find out more information and get back to you as well, if that would help.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see. No further questions, Representative Josephson. Next, we'll go to Representative Moore, Stapp, Schrage, and Bynum. Representative Moore.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Through the chair, I think a lot of us have spoken about the fears about double taxation with our cities and our boroughs that rely heavily on sales taxes already. And so maybe you guys can just give another stab at explaining, watering it down a little bit more for the public that's listening, how this is going to interact with this bill and with this. So is it a double taxation, or why not you guys explain that a little better for people that are listening at home?
Chair Chismanos.
Through the chair, Representative Moore. So double taxation is usually referring to an income tax where two states are taxing the same income twice. For a sales tax, it's a standard, and I can't think of one state that doesn't add a local tax on top of a state-level tax. So the tax is only applied once to the same item, and the tax there's a state-level tax in most states, and then they allow for some states have a cap the local can add. Looking at the numbers here, some of those are up to 11% at the local level on top of the state tax that's sometimes 4 to 5%, so that the combined rate is a high tax. And that would be the case here in some of our local communities that have a higher rate. So if there's a 6% tax and you add 2% state level on the off-season, then you're going to have a 8% tax.
Follow up. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. And then I have another question. If the department has modeled the household level impact on what the sales tax is going to do, especially for our rural communities, that the price of goods are already so high. Have you guys looked into that, modeled that, seen what that's going to do to those fly-in communities?
Mr. Stickle.
Sure. Dan Stickle for the record, Representative Moore through the chair. So yes, and also ICER has done that type of modeling as well, and we'd be happy to provide some information.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. We do have 20 more minutes in this meeting. We're scheduled to go until 10:30. If folks could start thinking about, I'll bring this question back to the committee, but if the Department of Revenue and the committee members can just think about whether or not we want to go over. I don't know if folks have commitments after this, in which case we don't go over, but if we are able to, I don't have anything until our next meeting at 1:30, and happy to go over if we can, but if folks can at least think about it, feel free to pass me a note. Otherwise, I can take an at ease before we gavel out and we can come to some kind of a determination. So with that, next up, I've got Representative Galvin. I was before Moore, so Representative Galvin and Stapp, Schrage, and Bynum. Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Appreciate the opportunity to ask just a couple more questions. One is, actually, I hope this will highlight a positive about this whole presentation, and that's around ratings. When I say ratings, I mean ratings for our state, and I know that we've already improved many levels, but what I recall in the conversation was that if and when there is a broad-based revenue measure put in place in Alaska, it likely will improve our ratings, which of course means that for any dollars that we owe out there, we will likely see a lower percentage that we would owe on top of that. And I'm hoping that you might speak to that. That is, what will this do, or how will this look to those who are Moody's or poor others who are out there in New York deciding what our rating should be, and will that save the state of Alaska money? And if you can give us some picture of that, I would appreciate hearing it.
Representative Galvin, through the chair, I would have to get back to you on that. Our state debt manager does a lot of the rating, meets with a lot of the rating agencies, and so I could get you more information.
Okay. I think I've heard from this panel, I think perhaps Mr. Stickle in the past, or maybe it was another economist, but if it's okay with you, I would like to hear just a broad statement around whether broad-based revenue would look good for Alaska.
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Dan Stickle, for the record again, to Representative Galvin through the chair. And, you know, as Acting Commissioner mentioned, we can get some detailed nuance and statements. Broadly speaking, a sustainable fiscal plan is going to be viewed positively by the rating agencies, and we would anticipate that that would be something that would favor positive ratings for state debt, which would save the state money.
Thank you. I appreciate that, because I know since things have changed, the balance has changed from 90% oil revenue, which now we know is fluctuates because of price much more. We're needing those dollars that are easy to spend for services, and then we have this investment fund that's doing quite nicely, but this other piece of revenue isn't in place yet, and so I have really thought about this quite a bit, and I know other states have found favor, or I should say the ratings companies have found favor in states who do have something in place, just as a safety measure, should there be a need for revenue that is steady. So I appreciate that, and I wanted to thank you again for bringing this to the table, because a broad-based measure is important. So thank you. Secondly, I have a question around, if I may, follow up.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. This one is around multiplier effect, and I think that some of you have touched on it a bit, being concerned about piling on taxes, and I want to think about what I've heard around multiplier effect of the 1.2 million passengers, for example, who come in on a cruise ship, and I've heard there's been some discussion around, can we add another head tax there so that we can make some money, for example, and what I hear from the cruise companies is if you add another dollar, we might lose a lot of passengers. So I just think about what this chamber and others who care so deeply about making sure that this influx of tourism still continues, that I wonder if they see that there's a tax on this set of individuals who are coming into Alaska to spend their money and spend their time. Have we thought about the multiplier effect, perhaps negative multiplier effect, perhaps not, but if we've done any research on that and whether or not it might shoo away some of these passengers or new visitors because they're concerned about the costs, I would like to hear that.
Sure. Mr. Stickle?
Dan Stickle for the record. Representative Galvin through the chair. So we've looked at macroeconomic modeling, similar to the type of modeling that ICER has done. That allows us to look at relationships between data and understand how, just as the numbers work, how a change in tax is likely to affect other variables like visitation and spending. That is one tool in the toolkit. that should be viewed alongside input from stakeholders. So one of the things that those models miss sometimes and can't perfectly quantify is the impact on the climate, the mm-hmm. business climate, the investment climate, the attractiveness of how individuals are going to respond. So I would view those as one important tool in the toolkit, but then hearing from stakeholders is absolutely another important tool.
Thank you. And for clarification, I do want to make sure that we're all aware, if you add head tax money onto cruise ship passengers, that fund has to go directly to something related to the cruise ship industry. So just to clarify, I get that. This was just an analogy that when we add on extra cost to any sort of a visitor, that may have a negative effect in terms of bringing in all of these visitors. So perhaps ATIA can weigh in on that as well, or someone else who's concerned about getting taxes into the high double digits, who already has a local tax, and what that might have, how that might affect folks. So thank you very much for the opportunity to ask that question. And I think it's clear to me that we have a lot of broad questions yet to be answered, and I'm grateful to be here hearing from you and learning from you about how we can make this piece of legislation very, very strong. Thank you.
Great, thanks. I am receiving a few notes here. Some folks can stay up until a few hours and some up until half an hour, so at least we've got a minimum of half an hour. But what I plan to do is we do have, looks like, three or four more questions, and then we'll take a three-minute break, let folks use the bathroom, grab some coffee, stretch your legs, and then we'll go into the next section, which is the corporate income tax and then the oil tax, oil and gas tax. So I don't know if we had a clarification question before we go to questions. Representative Moore? Okay. So in line, I do have Representative Stapp, Shragi, Bynum, Moore, and then Jimmy, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Foster. To the chair, to Mr. Spanos. Okay, so Rep. Allard kind of brought up a pretty good scenario here, and you mentioned something that kind of concerned me, which is basically that this policy, we have what's called planned noncompliance for failure to self-report, right? So you bring up goods. State has no mechanism right now for enforcement, so now we have Alaskans that are circumventing the law. Maybe they know or maybe they don't know, and it kind of made it sound like that's in the plan, i.e. noncompliance for payment. So first I'd like to clarify, are we actually planning for active noncompliance? And second, is there any legal repercussions for Alaskans or enforcement mechanisms when they would be indeed breaking the law by being noncompliant? Through the chair.
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. I always have to be careful what I say in a presentation. To clarify, what I was saying is what we've seen from other states, right? I go to tax conferences, I talk to other states, they tell me what they're seeing, and that's what they see, that there's noncompliance exists. We have noncompliance in our current taxes, and we take action where we can. And we've talked about those bills in this committee before. Our vehicle rental tax was one. And we, as the tax administrators, are obligated to enforce the taxes. So if we know about noncompliance and we know where it is, we enforce it.
Followed, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you. In the same line here. Okay, so that's kind of my understanding. Obviously, we know noncompliance is a thing, but you are the enforcer. And Alaskans who do not report things that they bought and brought here are violation of law. What's the penalty? What's the punishment? And how do you actually enforce that? Do we have random spot checks on vehicles that cross the border and search their receipts to see, hey, did you buy something out of state you got to pay tax on? Probably not. But I mean, like, what is the mechanism here to enforce law violations? So, through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. Title 43.05 is the general tax penalties that apply to all taxes and would apply to these new taxes as well. There is a failure to file penalty and it's a failure to file / failure to pay penalty, 5% per month up to 20% or 25%. I'll have to double check.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to know that if this bill does pass, indeed, people need to make sure that they are complying. Otherwise, that'd be a hell of an expensive piece of furniture, I'd imagine, if you had to pay the non-compliance taxes. You said something earlier through the chair, Mr. Spanos, that I'm very puzzled by. We reference the executive would not like to have taxes as well, but the fiscal situation demands it. I don't see that in the bill. I see the bill creates a constitutional liability that is far greater than the revenue measures are proposing. So why do we need this proposal, and what is the purpose of this proposal when the proposal spends more money than it raises through the chair?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, the governor's overall fiscal plan wants to maintain 50% of the dividend to the residents of the state, as well as close the budget gap that exists on paper, and this fiscal plan includes taxing in order to help close that gap.
Fault, Mr. Kocher.
Follow up.
The proposal doesn't close the budget gap based on your own projections. So, that's a good question, right? Does the proposal close the budget gap by constitutionalizing the liability by your own 10-year projections? Maybe that's for Mr. Stickle, through the chair.
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Dan Stickle for the record, to Representative Stapp, through the chair. And I believe you may have a handout that was provided by Office of Management and Budget. So we prepared a comprehensive fiscal model that included used the governor's 10-year plan as a starting point and layered on numerous options for levers around state revenue and state spending. That plan does have an initial draw from savings in fiscal year 2027 as we're working to implement the new revenues, but beyond fiscal year 2027, the plan is roughly in balance.
Mr. Representative Scott.
Until the sunset of the revenues and the payment is constitutionalized. So if I go 10 years out from today is 2027, if I go to 2037 and my revenue sunset, my liability is always there. How does that balance through the chair?
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Representative Stapp, through the chair. So in the fiscal model, in our fall revenue forecast, to be clear, we have kind of a lower revenue situation for the next several years, for the next 5 to 7 years. Once production starts to come online from some of these new fields, like the Willow and Pica field, and once those fields graduate from being eligible for certain incentives that apply for the first several years of new oil production, we are expecting a higher baseline a revenue outlook. We also have an assumption for growth in the permanent fund, which leads to a higher percent of market value transition. Also layering on, the administration is very optimistic around gas pipeline coming online, and we've layered on an assumption you have revenue from the AKLNG project starting to come online in the 2030s. And so this baseline revenue combined with the other elements of the fiscal plan in that modeling does roughly balance even as the sales tax and corporate income tax expire.
Last fault, Mr. Kocher.
Representative Stapp.
So if all those things happen, I'll just give you a nice round number. I'm basically saying I'm going to add a forever at least $1 billion liability. Obviously, it's simplified math because it changes. And the taxes are going to go away, and then the gas line and all this production is going to net me at least another $1 billion through the chair. Is that correct?
Representative Stapp, through the chair, that's the assumption, correct.
Okay.
And obviously, uncertainty around any forecast and any model.
Okay. Let's see here. Just so the public is aware, we're starting to get into a little bit of the big picture, and there's a lot of pieces that are out there. This bill is one of the pieces. This is the tax component of the governor's fiscal plan. He also has a spending cap bill and also the split of the permanent fund earnings and the bill for that as well. There's a lot to talk about here. In the lineup, I have Representative Schrage, Bynum, Moore, and Jimmy. And then what I'd like to do is I think AML, Alaska Municipal League, is most interested in speaking to the sales tax component. So before we go to the next section and before we get off of this subject, maybe I might let them speak. We'll take a brief break after we get through these questions. So with that, Representative Schrage.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Thank you to you all for being here. I really appreciate it. A tough meeting. I think you have the unenviable position of advancing a major fiscal policy change, which is, I think, something that everyone admits is incredibly difficult. Legislature's had challenges. The governor has admitted that this is a challenge, and it's tough to be here presenting that. So thank you for being here and having this conversation. I do think it's an important conversation that we need to have, and so I'm glad that we're having it. You know, I think we have had a lot of very challenging questions today that are fair, and there's a lot of concerns with this bill. Probably going to take us quite a while to work through these just based on how things are going so far. But I'd be remiss if I didn't take a moment just to maybe take a step back and think about the challenges that we have with the status quo. I think there's a lot of concerns with this specific proposal. I think we need to work through those and figure out how we might address those, or if they can be addressed. But we haven't really spent any time talking about the challenges that the status quo presents us. And I was hoping to just spend maybe a second talking about some of those things. You know, one of the opportunities that is presented to us in the next few years is potentially a gas line. And I thought that the governor did a fairly good job of articulating the concern that we have where if we have a gas line or some other major investment, whatever it might be in Alaska, that would result in a huge influx of people into the state of Alaska and a large increased burden on burden on state services and on our government. And so can you talk a little bit about how implementing a fiscal policy like this allows us to maybe restructure the way that we fund and decide the size and scope of government and how this would allow us to better maybe be flexible to major positive developments in the state of Alaska in the near future?
Mr. Stickle?
Mr. Stickle, you're the lucky
sure.
one here.
Dan Stickle, for the record, I could take a first stab at that, Representative Schrage through the chair. So looking at the status quo, and for the in terms of status quo, I'll look at the governor's 10-year plan that came out with the FY27 budget proposal and our fall 2025 revenue forecast. So oil prices are lower, and that's a fact. Our revenue forecasts have been coming down. There's cost pressure on various elements of state government, and if we assume that our revenue forecast holds and we pay a dividend in line with the governor's proposal and fund government at a fairly stable level, the CBR, our main savings account that we're drawing from, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, that won't last for long. And I think in the one of the slides that we presented, we're able to make a CBR draw for 27 and 28, and then it's gone. And so there is this structural fiscal issue that has to be addressed. As far as the broader questions around that, it does create uncertainty. So we as individuals know that something eventually will have to happen. We don't know what that is. So we can't make our plans. Businesses don't know what's going to be decided. And so there's a benefit broadly to having some sort of certainty and addressing that. That's very difficult to quantify. I know folks at Department of Labor and ICER have tried to quantify that, but it is an element that solving the fiscal system provides some level of certainty to underpin long-term decisions that individuals and businesses are making in the state.
Thanks for that. I think you know, one of our members talked about how this fiscal cliff is upon us. I think it's actually been upon us for quite some time. Some would say more than a decade. We've been aware of these challenges. And my experience talking with community businesses, and other stakeholders is that the instability does have a very negative impact on investment in our state and our ability to have some stability and even just public confidence in Alaska. And I think really we see some of that in the out-migration we currently experience. You know, one of the other things that has come to mind through all this discussion, I remember when Musin Ghatabi was with ICER years back, and he would talk fairly often about one of the challenges we face in Alaska is that we have a large outflow of money from the state of Alaska. It's generated here and then goes elsewhere, spent elsewhere, and flows out of the state of Alaska. The representative from Eagle River talked a little bit about the prospect of us taxing sales that occur outside of Alaska, and Alaskan goes maybe to Seattle to do some spending. Have you looked at, as our chief economist, can you speak at all about the impact of dollars that are spent here in the state and the impact they have on our economy when they are spent here versus what happens when we spend those out of state and we don't have any mechanism to recapture those dollars or rehome some of those back into Alaska through some tax mechanism?
Mr. Stickle?
Sure. Representative Shragi through the chair. Those are good questions. Generally, Alaska has we do have a fairly transient population. We rely heavily on outside companies and workers in some of our industries. And, you know, we do like to go outside the state for college to get some sunshine in the wintertime. So there is definitely some money that flows out of the state and money that flows into the state. An element of a broad-based tax that addresses a piece of that. So the sales tax is one element where, you know, we're not going to tax the money that Alaskans spend outside of the state, but we would be generating some revenue from the sales of outsiders spending money in the state. Generally, in the analysis that we've looked at around spending and employment, it tends to be that outsiders are spending more in-state than in-state folks are spending outside. So by putting in a broad-based tax, it would be a net positive for the state in terms of just those relationships of where money is being spent.
Thanks. I just bring these up to note that I think there are some I think legitimate reasons that we should look. There's trade-offs with any policy choice that we might make in the state of Alaska, and I think we've spent a lot of time talking about the concerns. I think that's very valid. There are a lot of concerns with this bill and the structure, and we're going to have to work through those. But I think the economic instability that we face, the negative business confidence and public confidence we have in Alaska, the out-migration, and the outflows of monies that we see from Alaska to other states are all challenges that could be at least partially mitigated or addressed through fiscal reform like this. And so I think it's an important conversation to have, and I think it's important that we remember there are ways that we can improve our fiscal structure. I'm not sure if this is the way to do it or this package is the way to do it, but it's a conversation we need to continue to have. Thanks.
Okay, I've got in line here Representative Bynum, Moore, Galvin, Jimmy, 3-minute break, and then AML. I'm starting to maybe think if there's a way we could hold off on questions, but we'll go ahead and jump into questions here, and then I'll think about this as we're going along. But we've got about half an hour, and I'd really like to get AML up here. So with that, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I know this is a very hot topic. I saw a bunch of fire chiefs in the building here yesterday. I was wondering if you might have had them on standby just in case a fire breaks out in here. So something to keep in mind. On a more serious note, we talked a little. Representative Galvin's trying to hit on this a little bit, talking about people in our communities, and we've been hearing this undertone about affordability in the state of Alaska. I know from my experience in my community, the biggest out-migration is specifically due to the cost of living in the community. And when I look at this plan on slide 4, one of the big components of this is to create long-term appeal for families and businesses by enshrining a 50-50 PFD, and it says predictable PFD. So the PFD is a major component of what we're actually trying to do here when I'm looking at this. Some of the arguments that I've heard have talked about, well, if we enshrine a PFD and we have this PFD available, that when people are paying their taxes, that we can transfer that and pay the PFD, and then they'll have the they'll have these big checks, and it'll offset that pain of paying the additional taxes. Then I get to thinking about my community, and we're trying to grow the community. And I see in this plan, there is absolutely nothing in this plan that will create stability in capital investment in the state, building things, having people working through that building of things, and making life easier for those people by us building things and doing things and maintaining things. This plan does absolutely nothing for that I can see. What it does is it taxes my community to ensure that we're enshrining a PFD. Okay. One of the challenges with that, and this is not a comment about the validity of the PFD program, but if I'm trying to grow my community and trying to fill teacher jobs and police officers and firefighters, and I'm not growing from within my own community, that means people are having to come to my community. And this tax that would be in place would be immediately imposed upon them. Yet they don't have the privileges of receiving a dividend because they have to wait. They could be here for over 2 years before they see any kind of relief. So on one hand, we're saying we're creating an enshrined PFD which will help Alaskans. And on the other hand, we're seeing that our communities are shrinking and costs continue to go up. And people are leaving, and I don't see how we level that with trying to make it more affordable for my community to grow. And this plan does absolutely nothing to do that. So when you did the evaluation on this, and we're talking about trying to grow Alaska and keep our communities healthy, was that something that was considered as part of the calculus? Because like I said, this is to transfer funds from collected taxes directly into the dividend program that's been enshrined into the Constitution. Was the element that I just spoke about, where we were trying to grow our communities, was that taken into consideration? Because many of those members are never going to, maybe we have members in our community that don't get the PFD, or they won't get it for many years. Was that something considered?
Commissioner Earls?
Through the chair to Representative Bynum, I would have to see if there was any economic research done on the impact to people leaving the state. I'm not sure that was completed. So I will look to Dan Stickle.
Mr. Stickle?
Dan Stickle through the chair to Representative Bynum. Broadly speaking, yes, we've modeled impacts of permanent fund dividend, taxes, spending. The sustainable fiscal plan would provide a stable source of revenue for a variety of government spending, to include dividends to Alaskans, to include providing government services, such as capital budget, education. Governor has been clear that providing a dividend is a priority, and when he set the fiscal plan that he put forward, that was a core part of the fiscal plan.
It's a follow-up.
Follow-up?
Thank you. Through the chair, I hear what you're saying there, but when we look at this plan, there's absolutely no way that we're actually doing any capital investment. We're not doing capital investment now. We're not maintaining operational expenses now. So nothing here is actually causing that to happen, but we're putting more burden on our communities to pay taxes. And one of the things that I find really challenging to understand with this plan is, on one hand, we're saying we want to have stability by imposing a sales tax because oil revenues are volatile. Then on the other hand, we're saying, but just wait 7 years, and we're going to go back to that that volatility, because that's okay. So I'm not sure that I understand that what we're saying. Sales taxes because it's not volatile, but it's after 7 years, that's going to go away. And I know that we're saying we're going to have additional resources coming online in the future. But the predictions and projections we have on here, the 10-year, don't show that we're going to create additional revenue. We just created permanent liability, like Representative Stapp was pointing out. Permanent liability for us with the deficits into the future and no investment in capital in this state. So I'm finding it really challenging to link the concept of stability through sales tax, but then we're just going to get rid of it in the future and going to depend on what we currently do. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. The last two, we've got Representative Galvin, then Jimmy, and then we'll go to our break and then have AML come up. And Representative Moore is passing.
She might have been first.
Representative Moore is passing.
Okay. Yeah.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Appreciate it. I have a couple of questions, again, around the sales tax, and this one in particular is around the implementation of the sales tax. I did a little bit of research back when I was thinking about the broader picture of how important broad-based revenue will be to our state, given diminishing revenue currently. And in that work, what I found was that it was pretty simple from a income tax point of view, just because you take, or you could, depending on how you want to pull the levers, you can just take one line from the federal income tax that everybody fills out, who's getting income, and as opposed to the sales tax, which puts a bit of work on all of the local businesses. And so I was thinking about this, and I don't see any slides on implementation and what that might look like, costs of implementation, things like that. And the idea of standing it up and then taking it away feels burdensome as well. And I just wondered if you could speak to that initially. I know that, and I want to add one other caveat, that what I had in place when looking at an income tax was that if they wanted to pay their income tax with their PFD, they could just place that check mark on the online tax form. And so this feels a lot different to me. We're putting the burden absolutely on businesses. And so would you help me with that piece, the costs of implementation, and it's kind of what that's going to look like to stand it up and then shut it down?
Mr. Spanos?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, thank you for the question. I don't think we're going to get to the fiscal note in our slides, but that's where the costs are embedded, and we maybe can come back and talk about that at another time. But generally speaking, a sales tax is not simple. It sounds simple. This body a decade ago passed a sales tax, or rather an income tax, that did not pass the Senate. That bill was one that we did a lot of work on internally. It is a complicated mechanism. It requires as much, if not more, employees that we're expecting here. This bill, I believe we landed on 67 employees for the plan? 67. I saw 34, but that's in year one. So 67 employees for this. I believe it was 72 for an income tax. You have a fiscal note on that from us, and I just can't remember it off the top of my head. So they're roughly the same as far as implementing. It's about $10 million a year for this costs of having those employees and other costs associated with travel, et cetera, for doing audit programs.
And if I may, a follow-up?
Representative Galvin?
Did you consider costs to businesses each, you know, that there would be perhaps an extra level of consideration with regard to the local businesses who may or may not have more paperwork or things associated with that as a business owner or business worker? I understand that for the state costs it would be one piece, but I'm thinking like the multiplier effect of other pieces to it.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the costs for implementing a sales tax at a local business, especially one that already has a tax at the local level, is minuscule. Their systems are already set up. Even if they're in a city like Anchorage that doesn't have a sales tax, the systems the point of sale system has a sales tax built into it. All they have to do is turn it on.
Turn it on. Okay. Thank you. That's good to understand. I appreciate that. And the other consideration, if I may have a follow-up.
Representative Galvin.
I think on a previous slide, or previously in this presentation, you mentioned that taxes like income taxes may be volatile because they're dependent upon what we think about future overall issues with relation to our economy, whether it's up or down. And so there was some discussion around how that is somewhat volatile. I would think similarly with sales tax, there's some volatility as well. I guess what I wanted to ask you is that when I think about that sort of volatility, if we're projecting out that there is some level of confidence that the sales tax is a better instrument, then aren't we also saying that we have some level of confidence that the oil fields and other areas are going to continue to bring us some positive returns? I think in our outlook, the reason that we're de-escalating not only corporate income tax, but also we're de-escalating the sales tax in this model, that the reason is that we expect other revenue to come in heavier. For example, our oil revenue, and of course that's considering that we think the oil price will be predictable. And if that's the case, then I would think that we're also we should consider that we will still have the high revenue workers in place in Alaska working on the oil fields. And I just want to make sure that you would agree with me that if we think we're going to get oil revenue in the next 10 years escalating, that you also would agree that there would be workers on those oil fields maintaining some level of high income.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, certainly.
And follow up to that particular question. And if you have done any research on the overall revenue from oil and gas wage revenue, what percent of the wage revenue comes from out-of-state workers?
I'll let Dan speak after me if he has that off the top of his head, but I'd be surprised. Actually, Dan always surprises me, though. So we do that modeling, but we didn't bring that. We weren't prepared to talk about an income tax today.
I appreciate that, but as we're considering one versus the other and whether how to best fill a hole, I think at some point if we can hear numbers, that will help us make decisions. A lot of Alaskans think that it's not right that people work, come up here and take the very best, highest jobs, highest paying jobs, and yet they don't put in to Alaska. And I appreciate some of your thoughts that, well, maybe they're going to be buying fishing poles and tents and things if they come up here. But I want to make sure that we're being mindful and thoughtful about what that bottom number really looks like. So I would appreciate it as being part of this conversation because, Chair, as you know, this is a bigger conversation that we have many levers to pull, and we want to make sure we're pulling the right ones that are appropriate for the revenue that we need now and in the long term.
Representative Jimmy?
Yes, thank you, Chair Foster. Before I begin, I'd just like to give a shout-out to the Akotan Takagan tribe for allowing us to conduct state business on their land, taxes. So I grew up not knowing about taxes. I, you know, get my little $1.25, go buy my pop and candy, not knowing I was paying a tax as a kid. Now when I know, I'm upset about that. But, you know, as we got our business and then I started understanding about tax. So in the rural, it's a pretty unique situation. We pay taxes on stuff, groceries that are flowing, building materials. And that freight is also included with the taxes. So on top of that, our business have to make money. So they add on to more, as you guys are well aware of, sometimes 2, 3, 4, 5 times more than what they are purchased at. And from what I understand, we pay taxes in the rural. Urban does not. And we pay year-round tax. So with seasonal income, meaning, you know, sometimes corporations come in or entities come in and help provide jobs, and somebody only works for like 6 weeks, and then the rest of the year they have no income. And now it's harder for people to get assistance. People are determined they're over income. In fact, when they're still struggling to make a good paycheck in the rural, but yet they're still struggling to pay for fuel, food, and still try to seek assistance, they're denied. So then it puts another burden on the family. So they're still struggling. Excuse my voice. So from what I'm understanding, this tax, we would be paying more and receiving less back in my own village, in my village communities. I'm sure you guys are well aware of, we had Typhoon Heilong, and a lot of homes in my district were damaged. Out of the bush, we can't have insurance. I'm sure you guys are aware of that. There's nothing to file. FEMA helped support people in the immediate moment. It wasn't designed to rebuild homes. It was designed to help repair homes. And this is not to, like, you know, extend the house. It's to not to build a man cave or a woman cave. It's to repair where they've been living for generations. Some of these homes were passed down, were built originally and passed down from their parents, which means a lot. So many people have to pay out of pocket. For building supplies, repair our homes, yes, but also for subsistence gear, for snow machines, for our four-wheelers, for our boats, that are our lifelines. They help us subsistence out in the rural. And, you know, basic things. And it all comes in by plane or barge. With this proposed statewide tax, sales tax, a tax that would apply to freight too, by the time those items reach my village, my communities, my constituents, it's going to cost 2, 3, 4 times more over than an urban area. I'm not an economist, so I'm asking honestly, how is a statewide sales tax meant to be equal when rural Alaskans face much higher costs for the same basic necessities, especially after a disaster?
Commissioner Earls?
Representative Jimmy, through the chair. I've heard that concern from others, and I think it spreads across all of the state. We have rural Alaska, for sure, has high costs. A lot of Alaska has high costs, and I'm not exactly sure how to answer every single individual Alaskan's answer.
If I may add to that, Mr. Chair, Representative Jimmy, thank you for the question, and certainly there are places in Alaska that are more expensive. Rural Alaska is more expensive than urban Alaska. To reiterate what the commissioner had said earlier, our acting commissioner said earlier, is that there is no perfect tax regime. It's difficult to build equity into a flat tax like a sales tax. There is an exemption for construction, at least, so for building of the homes, rebuilding of the homes, that the sales tax would not apply to that. And as I mentioned earlier, there's, you know, discussion can be had about other exemptions, but again, the current structure is a very broad base to allow for a low rate for rural Alaska, not just for rural Alaska, for all Alaska, but it benefits rural Alaska to have that low rate. So, but again, no perfect tax regime. We wish we weren't here talking about this either, that's the situation we're in.
Representative Jimmy? Mm-hmm.
So a family lost their whole house, all their clothing, all their everything, from memories to what they purchased to, like, which is expensive to ship out items. So what you're telling me is my constituent who lost her home, has no job, has no other way to pay for any of her bills. As her home is being repaired, She's selling her own dry fish just to make ends meet. So you're telling me, hey, you're going to have to go and pay. We all know eggs cost about $20 for a box. So now it's $80. And she's going to have to pay a sales tax to her village, which it should be paid because it's going to help the village run. But not only that, she's going to have to help pay a tax that will not benefit rural, but urban. That's what you guys are telling me?
So through the chair, Representative Jimmy, what we're saying is we're having this conversation. It would be upon you to pass the tax, and in which case, then yes, as the tax administrator, then I would be telling your constituent they would have to pay the tax. Until the tax becomes law, what we're saying is here's a solution that the governor is proposing and having that conversation.
Well, if this does pass, I really hope you guys will be willing to help me write what I need to tell my people at home and make it okay, because it is not okay. It is not okay for my constituents who is barely surviving have to help and pay for this kind of tax. I just want to put it out there. Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess I just want to say that I share Representative Jimmy's concern because it sounds like a sales tax is equal. Everybody pays the same 4%, for example. But, you know, when you've got cost of milk and cost of fuel and cost of groceries and cost of everything higher out in rural Alaska, that same gallon of milk is really being taxed more because if it's $10 for the gas of milk, for the gallon of milk as opposed to $5 in other parts of the state, then 4% of $10 is obviously more than 4% of $5. So anyway, just want to say I appreciate your concern. We'll go to one last comment here, Representative Allard, and then what my plan is to, I think technically, I don't know if we're recessing or we're just adjourning, but we will take up AML at the 1:30. And so I think that means I can adjourn. So with that, Representative Allard.
Thank you. I just a quick comment to follow up on Representative Jimmy. I understand about the whole community. We lost several houses. People lost everything in Eagle River with the earthquake we had. I think it was 2018, that November. And unfortunately, they still had to pay property tax. And so my district's also impacted, but we pay property tax. And I think most of the rural communities don't. And I have people in my district that pay anywhere between $10,000 and $15,000 in property taxes. So I think it's everywhere. I would forego property taxes in a heartbeat and pick up the sales tax. So if you can make that happen, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. With that, we'll figure out what our schedule is regarding going back to the other two sections that we need to cover, as well as the fiscal note. I know you also have a sectional in there as well, but I think we're hitting the high points pretty well, so we might not need the sectional. But with that, any final comments from the committee or Department of Revenue? Representative Jimmy?
Yes, I just wanted to clarify with Representative Allard, are property taxes local taxes?
That question is for Representative Allard.
Oh, I apologize. Can you speak closer? Okay, say it again.
Are property taxes local taxes, not statewide taxes?
The property taxes come from the municipality of Anchorage, yes.
Yeah. Okay, thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Any Representative Bynum?
So, Co-Chair Foster, appreciate this. Obviously, this is a very big topic. I think one of the major components of this bill is the sales tax portion of it. There are other measures in it that are worthy and important to talk about, but when we go to, I just want to make sure we're going to have enough time to really come back, stop where we stopped, and really be able to dive into this. And is that the intention?
There's a lot. Yes, you're absolutely correct. There's a lot here, I think, in terms of the questions that the folks have. In terms of some of the analysis that folks are asking for, this is definitely not the last conversation. I think the intent right now is to try to get the high level out there, the components of what the main point is. And then we're also going to go to take up some public testimony tonight. I think that'll be focused. Most folks seem to be concerned about the sales tax portion And so we'll focus on that when we go to public testimony tonight. We can still come back to public testimony and the other sections of the bill maybe at a later time, because we are not going to have a robust conversation about those pieces. But certainly with regard to your concern about the sales tax portion, this is, you know, there'll be more opportunities to talk about it. Representative Bynum?
For clarity. So this afternoon we're going to come back at 1:30 and we're going to get a presentation from AML.
Yes.
Will we also be hearing, will that be our only item of business for this particular?
That meeting we're supposed to have, I believe, ASME and ATIA at that meeting. What's today, Thursday? Yes, both Alaska Travel Industry. So we're going to take up, I think, AML first, probably maybe the first hour or so, and then the last half we'll take up ATIA and ASME.
Thank you very much.
I saw we had two other questions, Representative Tomaszewski and then Galvin. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I just want to thank the department for being here today and with the really difficult task of a fiscal plan. I, since I've been in this building for the past 3 years, the constant drumbeat has been, what is Alaska? What are we doing for a fiscal plan? And how are we going to make our ends meet? How are we going to make the budget balance? And I really thank the governor for bringing this difficult subject to us. You know, it does take strong leadership in your department, in the state. And I just thank you guys all for doing that. It's going to be a difficult conversation, and I look forward to having the time to really dig into all the aspects of this fiscal plan. So thank you all for being here.
Great. Thank you. Representative Galvin?
Thank you. Very briefly, I just wanted to make sure, for the record, I know I had asked questions that we didn't have recent data for around out-of-state employee wages and how much in all, and I wanted to give some reference of that because it is so important as we're thinking about our options and our levers. And so I'm going to give you data from 2024, if I may. At that time in 2024, we had 413,867 people working in Alaska at some point in the year, and 22.9% were non-residents. Of that, the non-residents earned approximately $3.8 billion, or 17.3% of total wages. This does not include our newer projects. That would be Pika, that would be Willow. Willow's now at about 50%, and of course that would not include the project that's coming, we think, perhaps, the gas pipeline that would have 10,000 workers, and they're estimating 50% would be from out of state, so that's another 5,000 workers. All of those they've estimated are at $175,000 per year wage, roughly. So I just want to make sure that we are getting all the information at the table as we include these very difficult conversations and decisions. That information came out on Monday, and it does not include federal employees. So I want to make sure to clear the record on that. And some of the federal wages are quite high. But anyhow, I want to make sure that we are thinking about all of our choices, what will impact especially the more vulnerable Alaskans in rural Alaska less. And we do have a lot of options on the table, and they're all going to be difficult, but some of them are more fair than others. Thank you so much for allowing me to put that on record. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Galvin. Last word, Commissioner Earls, do you have any comments or any of your counterparts?
Thank you, Chair Foster. I'm not sure if my counterparts do, but thank you. It's a difficult conversation. It's hard to be here, but we're happy for the interaction. So, I mean,
discussion.
The discussion, yeah, and getting the questions out there for everyone.
Appreciate your being here. Definitely a robust conversation. It's a conversation that needs to be had. And again, thank you for being here. And so going forward here, as I mentioned, we'll have AML first at 1:30. I'm sorry, yeah, AML, giving kind of the I assume the counterpoint, or at least raising some concerns about the sales tax, and from the local standpoint, representing the local communities. And then we'll go to ASME and ATIA, that's the Seafood and Travel Industries, at 5:30. So at that point, we'll have the discussion on the table regarding the sales tax. So I would encourage the public, if we maybe could focus on that as we go into public testimony at 5:30. And that's going to be, again, on House Bill 284, the Omnibus Tax Bill. We do anticipate a number of people calling in. I want to make sure that folks are able to get their comments on the record if they're wanting to call in. So if folks could maybe limit their testimony to 2 minutes. Folks also have the ability to email us their comments, and those can be sent to us at house.finance@akleg.gov. I'll be repeating that often during our testimony. So with that, if there is nothing else to come before the committee, we'll see you all at 1:30 and then 5:30. Department of Revenue, Commissioner, thank you for being here. We'll be adjourned at 11:06 a.m.